Arm's Length Reporting for investors who want the whole story. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
Hey, welcome in. Time for KER Politics. Got my friend James Farley on the line. We're going to talk totally about Obamacare as much as we can in 17 minutes. Believe it or not, James has been involved in this particular environment, this particular industry, for long enough that he said he thought he could explain it to you folks, just taking the first couple of segments of KER Politics. James, first of all, when you and I were talking off mic, you were saying that people really don't understand the Affordable Health Care Act. Could you tell me why you say that?
Certainly. We talk about Obamacare, and Obamacare gets lumped into just as being this one thing, which is an insurance funding mechanism for how people who have historically been uninsured or underinsured gain access to care. And that component of the Affordable Care Act is only about a tenth of the entire act. The rest of the act is about standardization of electronic health record systems and payment models and other administrative things that actually over time help reduce the overall cost, especially the administrative cost of providing care, and ensuring that how care gets measured for quality and patient safety and security are all done in a consistent way and are understandable for the public. And I think that's probably the biggest misunderstanding, is just throwing out this label of Obamacare, and yet there's all these other things that if you just take away the insurance piece, and within the insurance piece, the part that people haven't liked, which is a mandatory insurance requirement, and keeping those components that people do like, such as coverage for pre-existing conditions and oversight over cost control for medications and other things. It's about not throwing the baby out with the bathwater, because there's so much in this very, very large comprehensive act.
Well, the one comment I would make is most conservatives, obviously, according to the press anyway, most conservatives would like to dump the act. And the impression that I'm getting from what you're saying right now is that that isn't totally necessary. Is that correct?
Absolutely. That's absolutely correct. In fact, most of the things that were in the act have been being implemented on an annual basis. And each year, new things come into play that won't be repealed unless the entire act is repealed. So let me give you an example. As of this January 1, a new provision of the Affordable Care Act required hospitals to have transparent pricing, meaning if you go to the hospital and you want to know what's it going to cost for X care to get your gallbladder removed or to have a test, the hospital has to be prepared to tell you what the price is going to be before you get the service. Up until now, that wasn't a requirement. That's one of the components in the ACA.
I can't really see why that would, why anybody would be offended or would disagree with that particular component. Quite frankly, well, I mean, so few people, it makes so little difference what the actual cost is. And the reason I say that, James, is because, as you know, Kathy and I have been through a plethora of various medical procedures, including hospitalization, including major surgery, over the last 2 or 3 years. And obviously, I couldn't pay for the procedure that I had, but my insurance paid for it. And why would it bother me really very much what the actual cost on it was?
Well, that's because you have a kind of insurance. Presumably, you have Medicare, and you're buying Medicare Advantage, so you have bought up your coverage. If you have a commercial coverage, your health care coverage is through an employer, and they bought a high deductible, and the deductible is $5,000 or $10,000. Most people are not going to be able to ever reach their deductible, so that the 80% that their health coverage is providing actually kicks in. So they will become, they are right now, very, very price sensitive, the average person. And as long as we continue to have a kind of a perverse disassociation between cost and price, and the commercial side, which continues to be leveraging up towards high deductibles or other models of coverage that most of the weight of providing the finance for that is on the individual as opposed to the insurer, it will drive more and more concern about price sensitivity.
Would you say, in your opinion, in my opinion, I think the fact that the Affordable Health Care Act, there's a little play on words there, the fact that the Affordable Health Care Act is economically not feasible, I think is probably a bit of an overstatement. And am I correct in saying that?
I think that our society has evolved from this place where 50 years ago, we had a public health care system that took care of people who didn't have coverage, to one where we've created a tiered mechanism of uninsured and underinsured, and that underinsured category for people with Medicaid and Medicare. And then we have this sort of superinsured, those who are getting their coverage through employer-sponsored health plans, that tend to take the brunt of the cost and cost shift to one where now we have an imperative to rationalize our health care. It costs way too much and delivers too little in terms of value back to people. We have this imperative to step up and address this question of is health care, Is some component of it a basic requirement and necessity, or is it a personal privilege? And you're fortunate because you're of an age and you contributed, so you have Medicare to ensure that you're going to get basic needs met for at least 80% of the cost of those, and you're able to buy up the other 20%. But if you are not under Medicare, and you don't have private insurance, which is about half of our country, we've not really addressed the fundamental problem. So we're at a point where we may be looking at how do we provide for everyone equivalent of what you have of ensuring that your basic hospital acute care needs and everyday medical needs can be assumed, and assume that not all of the cost, but a significant portion of the cost in a universal way. And I'm not espousing universal health care, but I think we're at a breaking point where we have to have a different solution than what we have today.
Well, I want to talk about universal health care because I want to make sure I understand exactly what that means, the ramifications of it, and I want to make sure that all of our listeners totally understand what that means. Universal health care right now in conservative circles is a dirty concept in the sense that people claim it is simply not feasible within our economic system because of, numerous reasons. Number one, look at our deficit. Number two, look at the fact that, and this goes very closely along with what I just said, we just don't have the money to pay for it. We're going to address that fact right after, or that subject right after we take a quick commercial break here. Stick around. Going to be right back with James Farley.
Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome back. Continuing my discussion with Mr. Farley, James Farley here on universal health care, the Affordable Health Care Act. I want to talk, James, about the subject of universal health care, the single-payer system. Please explain that to us, if you would.
Well, single-payer would imply that the government, through a tax structure, is going to pay 100% of the cost. That's the short definition of it. And when I say 100% of the cost, that's for all health care. And generally, systems like Sweden that have a universal health care system, they're providing behavioral health, dental, all medical, hospital, ambulatory care through a single tax structure. That would be a universal health care system.
Now, let me rephrase that. Is there any substance to the complaint that, number one, if the government controls it, you're not going to really have health care? They're going to be able to dictate what you can have and what you can't have. Any substance to that statement at all?
I think it depends how it gets set up. There are other models. There are other countries that have health care systems that have a public and a private component. I'm going to keep using you as an example, where you have Medicare Advantage, and part of your care is covered through the tax that you've prepaid and that current employees and employers are paying into Medicare, and that's covering 80% of select components of your cost. The other 20% you are buying, you're paying for, and you pay for some components of your original part through co-payments and buying up services. And not everything is included. You have things that are excluded from your coverage.
Now, let me ask you this. If it's excluded from the... Give me some examples of some of the potential exclusions, because I think this is where there may be some misunderstandings. And then again, there may not be, man. I don't know. Talk about that if you would.
So, I think one of the things that has been the most out of control in our healthcare system, at least in the past probably 5 years, has been on the pharmaceutical side, where the cost of manufacturing drugs has not changed. In fact, in theory, it's gone down, but the price of those same drugs has gone up in multiples. It's like if you're a diabetic and you need insulin, the price of insulin has gone up many, many times in the last 5 years. But if you're on Medicare, it is locked into a price. So, and that's because Medicare is able to drive a price cap on that particular drug. But to your question of, well, what's excluded? Well, if you have a cancer and you want to take a particular drug that is has been gone through a genomic screening so that it aligns with your gene and do gene therapy, that probably won't be included because it isn't in that category of contemporary evidence-based medicine. And so experimental drugs would be excluded. And that's because they're just prohibitively expensive and yet to be proven as a commonplace medicine.
How do you feel about that, James?
I think that if given the cost of our healthcare delivery system, it is about the only way to rationalize the care. And yet, if somebody wants to buy up, meaning they want to buy an umbrella or buy the equivalent of the Advantage side of an offering, that there's the ability to do that. It's a way of finding a middle ground that provides a base coverage of care and yet still allowing a mechanism through an insurance mechanism for people to buy up and get additional coverage for either additional benefits or services that are not included in a quote-unquote base plan.
Well, I think there'll be a lot of complaints about that, and there'll be a lot of very, very emotional emotional tirades on that particular issue, because I mean, when you and then there, I think it is where comes the you know, the terminology death panels. And I personally, having been through what I've been through of late and what my wife has been through of late, I would say that I would have a bit of a problem if that were excluded. Now, am I being rational when I say that? I'm really not sure. It's a pretty emotional subject. So long story short, when somebody opines on the concept of single payer, it's not necessarily bad, but it think takes out a lot of the element of personal choice. Am I correct in saying that?
No, that's not true. Just like right now, you have an option under Medicare to seek a universal Medicare where you could go anywhere, or you can elect to select an Advantage plan that defines a more narrow network and may have a formulary of drugs or other things as mechanisms to help keep the cost down and help coordinate your care. But you have the choice. You are electing to go with Medicare Advantage as opposed to keeping just plain Medicare and going wherever you want. So I would be very reluctant to say, no, it locks somebody in. It doesn't. You still have the freedom to go where you want.
Now, I want to say one thing to our listeners. I've known James for a long time, and the argument that James is presenting right now is based on his experience within his particular industry. And I have to say that it really isn't based on politics, because James is basically a conservative. Now, when I bring that up, I bring it up because the party, obviously, that is 1,000% behind single payer is typically the Democratic Party, and the Republican Party, I would have to say, perhaps, is not looking at it objectively. James, we only have about 20 seconds here. Am I correct in that assumption?
You know, Al, like you said, we've known each other for a long time. I'm a fiscal conservative. I think we have a cost and a price problem, and I'm only saying what I am because I think we have to come up with an economic solution to it, and it's a viable way, I think, long-term to get us out of a bad situation as a country.
Okay, there you have it. I'm going to be right back. Stick around after the top of the hour news break. I think you're going to find the next half hour to be incredibly fascinating. James Farley, thank you so much.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome back. Continuing on with KER Politics, where I'm speaking right now with a woman who is a retired trial attorney. Her name is Nancy Dennison. I got to tell you, she's a delightful lady. She has written a number of books on her highly unusual near-death experience, and we're going to talk about that. The reason we're going to talk about that in the political section is because of all you folks on our blog. Every one of you is a near and dear friend of mine, has become a near and dear friend of mine, and we've all got the same demographic when it comes to age. You know, when Ryan called me, Ryan McCormick, and said, I'm writing to bring your attention to Nancy Dennison and her highly unusual near-death experience. You guys are going to love this, particularly you, Mr. Irish. You need to worry. Having said that, Nancy, tell us just kind of in briefly a little bit about Answers from the Afterlife, insights into what happens to us when we die. There you go, my dear. You're on.
Answers from the Afterlife is actually my fourth book, and I solicit questions from my readers, and they make comments on YouTube, and they send me emails, and I put all their questions and all my answers together into a book, so that by topic, so that you can look up and see, you know, what I learned in the afterlife about specific topics. The three books before that were basically just documenting everything that happened to me and everything that I learned while I was in the afterlife. They're not autobiographies. The only thing in there that the only thing interesting about my life is that I died. So my death was more interesting than my life. And now my most recent...
I'm sorry, you were in the hospital, if I'm not mistaken, when this happened.
I was in the hospital getting ready for breast cancer surgery, mm-hmm. having a radiological procedure where they stick a wire into my breast, you mm-hmm. know, to mark the tumors. And I had an allergic reaction to the local anesthetic, and I also had very low blood sugar. Mm-hmm. And the combination of the two just killed me, literally.
But you're still with us, my dear, and from all the conversation that we've had so far, I would have to say that is incredibly interesting. Now, I'd like to talk about a number of things that your publicist sent me. Number one, there are five insights that you obtained after your near-death experience. What are they, and can you elaborate on each one, please?
I don't know what they are because feel like I learned any insights. I got knowledge deposited directly into my mind from our Creator.
Now, the one thing I asked you earlier is you said that you're not an atheist. When you use the word Creator, that's using it perhaps just to be perhaps a little bit more rounded, for lack of better terms. Now, the one insight that comes to mind here that I think is kind of interesting is you wrote that there's no devil or hell. All people return to the same place after death. How did you learn that, Nance?
Partly by doing it, and there partly because of all this information that was downloaded into my mind, and partly because I saw creation, and I saw that in the beginning there was Source. Source mm-hmm. is what we call God or Yahweh or the Supreme Being, whatever. And it created this entire universe using its imagination and its mental energy.
Mm-hmm.
And it did not create a hell or a devil. I also learned through communication directly with this entity, the Source, that we are part of it. We are literally part of its self-awareness, its consciousness, and therefore life...
So we're part of the Source, is
occurs.
What you're saying. Yeah.
We're part of the Source, and life occurs solely within its mind. And when we're finished with life, feeling like we've been an individual, feeling like we want to incorporate, you know, feeling like we're gathering experiences, we just wake up and realize that we're Source. And that's what happened to me. I woke up and realized I was Source, and it blew my mind.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why there's no reason to fear a devil or hell or even dying, because the worst thing that can happen to you is you wake up.
Hmm.
And it's fabulous.
Where are you, if you don't... I mean, obviously, let me ask some pretty simple questions. When you say it's fabulous, where exactly... So you're part of... I'll use the word God, because everybody knows I'm pretty avid Christian. But a number of my friends also, I have to say, the Source is probably... it's probably a more of an accurate word. I don't know. But so what, you wake up and you're part of the Source? Is that what you're saying?
That ultimately, when we first leave, you know, these human lives, when these bodies die, mm-hmm. we go into the light and we wake back up to our consciousness of ourselves as spiritual entities. And when I was there, I look back at my life as Nancy, I could not believe that I ever thought it was real. I mean, it was just absurd to think that this, you know, insignificant little life with, you know, that was restricted and painful, that was really real. Because in the afterlife, that feels much more real in comparison. And It just felt like part of me was asleep, living the life of Nancy, and it woke up, and I was in the afterlife, where I usually am.
That's interesting. Now, one thing I want to read here real quick, something that Ryan sent me, is that we don't enter into human life to evolve, to learn how to love, or to learn how to be more spiritual. We souls are already pieces of Source God's self-awareness and cannot get more evolved, loving, or spiritual than while in our spiritual state. That's a pretty interesting statement. And you learned that from
waking up and realizing that I was Source pretending to be Nancy.
Now, how did you come to that conclusion, Nancy?
I didn't come to that conclusion. It was information planted directly in my mind.
And
that was, the most unique thing about my afterlife experience. And there have been other afterlife experiencers who do get knowings. Most of us that get them call them knowings, mm-hmm. because when the information is implanted in your mind, it feels like you know it 360 degrees worth from personal experience.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I received knowings on just a zillion different topics. I didn't figure anything out or come to any conclusions, and none of this is my original work. I'm just the messenger.
That's interesting. You go on and you say, we are souls that have full freedom of choice about whether to incarnate. Explain that to me, if you would.
The reason why Source created us, the people that think, that we're individuals, you and me and everybody else out there, was kind of the same reason we dream. It wanted to focus down on smaller experiences, smaller parts of itself, and experience things that a huge, infinite entity cannot. And so imagine this universe and then populated it with people, places, and things.
Yeah.
And wants to experience all of that. And so Source puts its own consciousness into every part of creation. And I call those little parts of Source that we call souls inside humans, I call them light beings, because that's what they look like in the afterlife.
That's anyway, really so interesting. Nancy, I've got to take a commercial break, and I'm sorry, we're at 9:06, and I've got to take a break here at 9:10. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to be right back with Nancy Dennis, and I got to tell you, this is one of the most interesting things that I've heard in a long time. Hang on a sec. We'll be right back. Hey, Nancy, let's wrap up this, or let's begin this particular segment. Let's talk a little bit about my question in the prior segment about incarnation.
We individual souls have, light being parts of Source, have the option of incarnating into physical matter. We don't have to. And we always choose for ourselves what we want to incarnate into. And we also choose, a theme or a subject that we want to study. So we might choose a theme that's unique to humans, greed, and we will come into a human life and many human lives after that, always studying the theme of greed from every conceivable perspective. And we choose to do that. It's not karma that in one life we, were the victim of greed, and in another life we were the greedy person. We choose it in order to round out our knowledge, and it's that personal experience of all of us souls that constitutes those knowings that were dropping into my mind while I was in the afterlife.
Mm-hmm. This is really fascinating. I'll pick up. You've written 5 books, and I'll pick them up and read them. I really find it to be interesting. Let's get back into a little bit about. I mean, being a Christian, I'm going to call Source God, and I believe that God did give us free will. Well, what you just said elaborates on that, I would have to say. You know, God did give us free will. Source, for lack of better terms, did give us free will. I'm trying to think. Now, when you talk about the universe, i.e., the source has to have an infinite amount of parts, correct?
Yes.
Now, how would that relate to the fact that you've got a bazillion universes out there, you've got a bazillion universes where people populate, whether people want to admit it or not, that's what I believe, and how would this relate to that particular subject?
Well, I'm not sure how you're using the word universe, but what I learned worlds, different planets and things?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah, because I learned there's only one universe, and that source is infinite and eternal, and so are we, and it chooses to incarnate. Well, in fact, while I was having my life review, I got back every single moment of memory of hundreds and hundreds of other lifetimes I'd lived throughout the universe as creatures and things. And I remember one time I was this gaseous substance that was self-aware and intelligent. And I remembered every single moment of those lives while I was there. I don't remember them now.
Right, right. That's really interesting. Now, something else that Ryan sent me that I thought was interesting, and that's the following. After you died, you described merging with the source, the creator of the universe and all living things. How would you describe source, and what is it? And I'm sorry, and is it what many people would consider to be God?
Yes, my understanding is that what I'm calling source is what I grew up. I was a Roman Catholic. I had 12 years of Roman Catholic education, 6 years of Methodist college. So what I call source is what other people call God. And the reason why I started calling it source was while I was there, it didn't have a name. And
I wouldn't think it would need a name.
It doesn't. But I realized that it was the source of all life, the source of creation, the source of all energy. So the name just seemed to fit. And then I found other near-death experiencers who use the same word.
Now, here's another interesting question. During your after-death experience, you state in your books that you saw events that would occur in the future, including the end of humanity as we know it. Can you describe some of these events and what ultimately causes the demise of humanity? I mean, I'm kind of a fallen away Roman Catholic. I'm pretty active now in a Lutheran church, but be that as it may, you know, I know the Catholic stick pretty well. And this particular paragraph that Ryan sent me really goes along with, you know, the end of time concept. So how would you describe it?
I watched the creation of planet Earth and its entire development, and mostly focusing on the development of religion to its demise. But that was in 1994, and a lot of the things that I remember seeing have already happened, so they wouldn't be future things now. But I think the most interesting part of what I saw in the future is really what's going on now. I saw the collapse of our economy to the point that the federal government went bankrupt because it bailed out the insurance companies who were bailing out or paying claims for so many natural disasters. And when I saw that, AIG bailout, that, when that first started happening, I thought, oh my gosh, that's, this is it. But I think it takes more years than just, one or two. I also saw that our solar system has a lot more planets in it than, the nine that I learned in school. And one of them has been discovered since I saw that in the afterlife. The others haven't yet, but I think they will be. The end of the earth, I did see that, and I remember thinking, oh, it goes the same way Mars did. But I remember seeing Mars as a green, verdant planet with life and, you know, populated and everything. And all I can remember of what happens to Earth is it goes the same way Mars did. And I don't remember how Mars was turned from a green planet into what it is now. I got so much information, you know, and I couldn't hold on to it.
You know what?
I couldn't hold on to it when I was coming back in the body.
Yeah. I have a question I want to ask you that I think is really, really germane. We're down here. We've got about 3 minutes left here. But what I think is really germane is, when was your book? Your book was published, back in 93?
I think my first one, I think, was 2007, maybe.
Did you predict did you experience any of the events that have happened between, let's say, the date that this book was printed and published, and today? Give me as many examples as you can.
Well, a lot of what we're seeing in the way of natural disasters, I saw a lot of those. I saw the Mississippi River Valley. I saw that expanded to the point where it was no longer a river. It looked more like, you know, a triangular shaped body of water that goes up through the center of the country.
But that really hasn't happened yet, though. I don't think
the erosion has started. You know, New Orleans flooded. You know,
yeah.
And then I saw Japan underwater, and after disaster there, you know, they did kind of sink a little bit. What else did I see? And some of the financial stuff, I said that, you know, that has come to pass. The mutation of viruses and bacterial infections from animals transmitting to humans, that's happened.
Nancy, let me do this. I want to make an offer to our listeners here. We have a very active blog. We got some very bright people on our blog. And what I would like to say is, if you have any questions, this is probably not the last conversation we'll have on this particular show with Ms. Dennison. If you have any questions, please articulate them to me on the blog, and I will certainly pass them on to Nancy. No opinions here whatsoever from Big Al. All the opinions, all the responses will be coming directly from you, if you don't mind. And I'm very intrigued by this subject. I'd like to know, CFS, what you think about this. CFS David Collum is a retired tenured professor at Purdue University in physics. We have a lot of very bright people in our blog. Please get the information to me for any questions that you have, and we can have a very interesting dialogue. I'm a pretty, I don't want to say unscrupulous because I'm not, but I'm a pretty inquisical guy. And let me tell you, I'm very interested in this subject. Nancy Dennison, thank you so much, my dear.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.